This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Week in Review on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin and welcome to the show that puts the media and the news in the spotlight. This week we speak to Filipino blogger Tonio Cruz for a consumer's view of journalism. But before that, we have three stories from Asia Calling. South Korea confronts history of abuse within its military. Prisons with invisible walls are being built in the Philippines, and India has its first female taxi service. Six South Korean soldiers are accused of killing one of their fellow conscripts when a soldier died earlier this year after being force-fed and beaten. Abuse within South Korea's military ranks has long been a problem. A recent survey of soldiers revealed about 4,000 allegations of violence that went unreported. Correspondent Jason Strother spoke with a former South Korean conscript who endured repeated abuse while serving in the military.
It's a time that almost all South Korean men dread, the moment when they begin their mandatory service in their country's armed forces. Kim Tae-hwa joined the ranks of Korea's riot police when he began his conscription 10 years ago.
I didn't want to go to hardcore army, and it sounds like riot police is mostly you are living in police department, which is city. You don't have to living in a mountain. So also there are more vacations.
But Kim, now 29, soon found out that duty in Korea's riot police was anything but a vacation. He tells me about his first experience of violence, which happened soon after he started his service.
I remember one senior got a BB gun with some gas like that. And actually he was aimed to me. And they just shoot my face, and then suddenly some bleeding coming out like that. And then I almost upset. I just wanted to go home.
But Kim couldn't go home. For the next 2 years, Kim says he and other conscripts were constantly beaten, tortured, and humiliated by their senior officers. Kim has a theory as to why it happens.
No one wanted to go to army, and they are forced to come there. So they got stressed. They wanted to kind of stress out. And the junior is really good target to stress out, because when they are junior, they got same abused. When they became a senior, this is the target. Everybody do this, so I'm gonna do this without guilty feeling. So I think this kind of isolated, really stressful situation make people really crazy, I think. Really crazy.
Kim says the only person he confided in about the abuse was his father, who more or less told him just to deal with it. An Mi Ja's son, Yoon Sung-ju, didn't tell anyone about the violence he was suffering inside his army barracks. I met her outside the military courthouse where her son's fellow soldiers were standing trial for causing his death.
I didn't know what was going on. So when they told me that my son has died, I didn't believe it. It wasn't until I saw the bruises on his body that I found out what was going on.
The details of her son's abuse were only made public 3 months after his death. That was thanks to an investigation by the Military Human Rights Center. Lim Tae-hoon, the group's director, says that violence will continue unless the system is changed.
The problem is that the punishments are not severe enough. Soldiers accused of violence should be tried in civilian courts, and the military's courts and prisons should be abolished.
South Korea's Ministry of Defense declined an interview request. Some South Korean media reports say that some abused soldiers try to escape the cycle of military violence by taking their own lives or the lives of their abusive senior officers. The latest of several revenge killings occurred in June when a sergeant went on a shooting spree, killing five of his comrades. He was allegedly a victim of bullying. Former conscript Kim Tae-hwa says he knows the feeling.
I was kind of getting crazy because, I mean, there's no way to protect myself. I thought if something happened really, I can't endure anymore. Maybe I can't. I have to kill him.
Kim says not all of his memories of his time spent in South Korea's riot police are negative, but it's not an experience he'd want anyone else to go through.
I do not want my son go to the army.
Kim adds that no matter how many improvements are made for the lives of conscripts, some things might never change. For Asia Calling, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
In the Philippines, rather than sentencing murderers and rapists to death, some are being sent to prisons without walls. At Asia's only such jail, 3,000 inmates live and work on a 30,000-hectare piece of land in one of the country's most beautiful regions. Jofel Tosorio and Ariel Carlos take us on a tour of this very different prison.
Carlo Mercedes works, like many people, behind a computer in this simple office for 8 hours a day. Monday to Friday.
Then I get weekends off to spend time with my family.
The only thing is that Carlo is a prisoner who is serving 30 years for rape, and his office day is broken up by roll counts.
Sa umaga po, meron po kaming counting ng 6 o'clock ng umaga.
At 6 in the morning, we have head count. Then we go back to prepare to go to the office at 8 a.m. We go home at 12 noon to have lunch, then go back at the office at 1 p.m. At 4 p.m., there's another head counting. Then we can go home.
He's one of 3,000 inmates in this unique prison without walls.
7 years na po.
I've been here in Iwahig for 7 years. I don't know when I will be released, but I already served my minimum sentence since 2011.
Carlo has served his minimum sentence, so he's allowed to live in a halfway house with his wife and 3 young children. They go to this school inside the open-air prison's facility. Newer inmates serving time for murder, rape and drug dealing are also free to work inside the prison grounds during the day, but are locked up at night.
Iwahig is called a prison without walls.
Richard Swarskoff Jr. is the penal superintendent, and he's proud of Iwahig being one of the biggest open prisons in the world and the only one of its kind in Asia.
We can say about the uniqueness of Iwahig as prison without bars, maybe because of its vast location, national environment, and way of treating inmates. I must say that some of our existing programs being undertaken can be adapted if suited to other prison facilities.
There is a rice farming, coconut plantations, poultry, fish pond and vegetable farms on the 30,000 hectares prison. Based on their skills, inmates are given jobs from farming to office work, and the place has also become somewhat of a tourist attraction. Aldrin, who is serving for 20 years for a crime he doesn't want to talk about, makes a living from selling handicrafts to tourists.
Those who want to see Iwahig Prison and penal farms and our historical buildings, please visit us. You can help us, inmates, by visiting this facility and buy souvenirs items.
One of his customers today is Robert James from Manila.
When you heard the word prison, normally you think of inmates being behind walls. So I thought Iwahig will be dangerous because inmates are outside. I was afraid that they might harm us. Because you see, they are convicts. But my impression has changed. It is really safe here.
During the Spanish colonial period, descendants were exiled to this area. Under American rule, it was also a penal colony. The prison is surrounded by thick mangrove forest, a mountain range, and a highway. These natural barriers are the only things that separate the prisoners from the outside world. It serves as Sabido's job as a prison guard to keep track of the inmates. He says each year, around 4 or 5 escape.
It's not easy to guard so many inmates, but the number of guards has been increased. We have also implemented new security measures, and we are strengthening our rehabilitation and reformation programs. This helps the inmates to have a clear outlook on life and not think of escaping anymore.
Xerxes and the other guards also live on site.
We are given a piece of land here to build our house so our families can stay with us. This is also one strategy of the Bureau of Corrections to keep the employees near when something happens, like when a prisoner escapes.
Penal Superintendent Richard Swarskoff Jr. says those who escape are usually easily caught. He would like no one to escape, but instead of building walls, he is working on making prisoners want to stay.
We have many reformation programs being implemented and enhanced, such as the basic education and technical vocational training for the inmates, of course, the moral and religious, sports and recreation, behavioral modification, health and welfare, and work and livelihood programs for the inmates.
Back at the office, inmate Carl Mercedes is encoding a file on his computer. He says while he feels lucky that he can still live with his family, he longs for life outside prison without walls.
As an inmate who lives with his family, I'm happy. But as a prisoner, it is not as happy as when you are a free man in the society.
Penal Superintendent Richard Swarskoff says that 10% of Iwahig's prisoners became repeat offenders after being released. This is lower than the national average. The jail has also had no recent history of riots or mass breakouts. Most other jails in the Philippines have brutal conditions, with inmates packed beyond capacity in dingy, airless cells and having to take turns sleeping. With the Real Carlos from Palawan, Philippines, this is Joffel Tesorio for Asia Calling.
New Delhi is infamously known by many as India's rape capital, with one woman being raped every 20 minutes. After the brutal gang rape of a young woman in December 2 years ago, the Supreme Court said that it's not a city safe for women. Most women say they routinely face harassment, especially on public transport. But one group of women is trying to get around the problem with a taxi service for women by women. As Bismillah Gilani reports, it's a small step, but one which could have significant impact.
21-year-old Chandni stands out in her blue uniform. At a car parking lot in New Delhi, she is getting her taxi ready to pick up her first customer. Chandni is one of just a handful of female taxi drivers.
People always say that men and women are meant to do different work. There are certain things like cooking, stitching and embroidery that only a woman is suited to. Where jobs like driving and plumbing are considered to be a male domain. This is actually an artificial division. I want to break down the barriers. And today I'm so happy that I've achieved what was always thought to be impossible for women. As commercial drivers, we've crossed all these social barriers and destroyed many myths.
On her white car is a sign which reads, "Cabs for women by women." It's a premium taxi service driven by women for women. It's run by a non-profit NGO, Sakha Consulting Wings, and supported by the Azad Foundation. Women's safety is a hot topic in India, and the service was launched to empower women and ensure their safety on the roads. Nayantara Janardhan is Sakha's chief operating officer.
We firmly believe that we are empowering women across society. So at one end of the spectrum, we are empowering the resource poor women from the urban slum by providing them some kind of, you know, training, empowerment, training which is to do with skill, to do with empowerment, to, you know, providing them a livelihood. And at the other end of the spectrum, we are actually empowering middle class women who are using our services. The other thing is this increased reportage of crimes against women in the public spaces. And we just thought this is one way to help women reclaim public spaces for themselves.
There has been an alarming increase in the number of sexual crimes against women in recent months. New Delhi is now infamously known by many as India's rape capital. with one woman being raped every 20 minutes. The brutal gang rape of a young woman in December last year provoked national outrage and a widespread demand to ensure women's safety. Nayantara Janardhan says the incident has created a greater demand for their taxi service.
I would say about 35 to 40% more calls per day, easily. So a lot of people actually called us to verify if the service exists. And what was very interesting to note that there was a huge number of calls from across the world of people calling up and asking how can we help us to actually grow the service.
Drivers like Chandni feel a great sense of pride being a female taxi driver, but also face many challenges. The biggest of which is the way they are treated by their male counterparts.
The moment they notice a taxi with a woman driver, they immediately start honking and overtaking. And if we're taking a rest in a parking lot sitting in our taxis, they gather around the car and stare at us as if we're aliens. We can't even rest for a moment. This happens almost every day.
But another female driver, Rita, says she has got used to it. But Rita is concerned about how male drivers' behavior towards them could be a danger to other road users.
It happened only this morning. I was on my way to pick up a passenger and was in a bit of hurry, so I overtook a male driver. He initially offered me space, but soon he brought his vehicle parallel to mine and kept staring at me and smiling. I reminded him that he was driving and must look ahead, but he didn't listen and bumped into another vehicle at the traffic lights. It caused a long traffic jam and he got a good beating.
All 10 of the current female drivers at Sakha Cab Service are put through a rigorous training course, and there are more trainees signing up. It's more than just a driving lesson, because it also touches on gender issues, women's rights, communication skills, and self-defense techniques. Rita gained a lot more confidence after joining the taxi service as a trainee. She was married off to a neighbor when she was just 13, but she challenged the marriage, and she is now independent. She doesn't want to think about getting married again.
What does one know of marriage at 13? I was never asked about it. But even if I had been asked, what does one know of such things at such a young age? And why should a person give anyone authority to decide others' fate? It's much better to be your own master and live life on your own terms.
The whole training is a life-changing experience, including for the trainers like Rakesh Kumar.
I came here with a traditional mindset and with a firm belief that women were not fit for male jobs. So I was very uncomfortable for the first few weeks because I had feeling that I was wasting my time, that they didn't have the ability and wouldn't learn however hard I tried. But after some time, I began to realize that it was just male prejudice that was making me feel all this. And then slowly, I began to view the matter more objectively, and things started changing.
Sakha is planning to expand its services and is holding consultations with the government to create opportunities for women in all types of public transport in Delhi. Sakha argues that this will make the city safer for women. Drivers like Chandni are eagerly waiting for the opportunity to work as bus drivers and turn Delhi into a safe capital for women.
जैसे टैक्सी तो सब हायर नहीं कर सकते, अगर हम लोकल ट्रांसपोर्ट चलाएंगे तो शायद हम दिल्ली को और सेफ रख सकते.
Not everyone can afford a taxi, so if we get to drive local transport, we could make Delhi safer. So it's also necessary because we know on the basis of our experience that women face harassment and sexual violence on buses. And whenever it happens, the bus driver, who is a man, does not stop the bus because he doesn't care what happens to the woman. If we have female drivers, we won't have this happening, and we will soon see a marked improvement in the overall situation.
From New Delhi, This is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio Anam Lapanha in Jakarta. Next up, we listen to a consumer's perspective on journalism. I'm Sharad Kutin, and you're listening to The Week in Review, BFM 89.9. Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin, and The Week in Review continues. I met up with Filipino blogger Tonio Cruz on the edges of the Southeast Asian Press Alliance Conference on Media and Internet Freedom held in Kuala Lumpur recently. Tonio writes about politics and technology and is also a newspaper columnist. He spoke on a panel about online and offline media and took the crowd, largely made up of journalists, by surprise with his views. I asked him why he thought they were so taken aback by his thinking on the media.
I think it was important to stress the perspective of the audience about the media. That, number one, new media as we know it is no longer new media. It's what the audience demands right now. The way news was delivered before, at certain times of the day only, no longer applies. When we say news, we just go to Twitter because we follow the news outlets there. News delivery and news reporting has become on time and on demand. So it's a radical change. And that change partly comes from technology and another part comes from the demands of a changing landscape. So the audience is changing. They can no longer wait for the news at 6 p.m. So if something big happens in between the early morning newscast and the 6 p.m. primetime news, their minimum expectation is that it will be reported as it happens. So that's, we cannot imagine that happening 15 years ago or 20 years ago. So I think we have to declare that change is happening so that the media would be on its toes and change along with their audience.
Now, while you contribute a column to a newspaper, as you explained just now, you're not a journalist as such. You didn't have the training. And I guess in an audience full of journalists, they see the values or the methodologies that journalists are steeped in, that have developed over, 100 or so years of, say, the history of the print media, for instance. And they see that as important, yes, people can't wait, but if they can't wait, then they're likely to get the wrong information, or they're going to get information that's without context or without adequate context. All those things that are very important to journalists when they think about information and the quality of public discourse. I mean, how does somebody like yourself, who very rightly says, well, the times are changing, and you got to change with them. Do you think you're too easy or too quick in your dismissal of those methods and values that traditional journalists have?
I think journalism remains relevant, but the way journalists are practicing journalism should change. For example, before, the sources are limited. It's only for government, the military, the church or the faiths, business, and then civil society or other people's movements. Right now, because of the blossoming of technology, the people themselves are either introducing new subjects, new themes, or demanding to be heard in the stories. So that's a marked difference. And I think there should be change that accompanies the practice of journalism to accommodate people who would like to be included in the news. And I think however noble the great record of journalism is, for the most part of its history, it was just an elite group of people, like sort of the high priests of journalism, the great editors, the great reporters, and they practice journalism in exercise of our rights, representing us to practice the fundamental right to receive and impart information, to express ideas. That's why there were newspapers, radio stations were put up, TV stations were put up, and those are expensive media. But with the introduction of the internet, it's no longer difficult for anybody to take hold of a medium, receive, impart information, or express themselves. That's Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Everyone has the right to receive and impart information and so on through any medium. So my point is, I think we're moving in a better place because the people have their own medium, social media, the websites, the blogs, organizations also have their own medium. The mainstream media, as we knew them before, are also going online and going social. We're going to a good place because there would be more space to cover, more voices to be heard. And I think that's better for any democracy, for any society. Not only of the same voices since time immemorial, the rulers, the priests, those who own the land, or today they own the business, the armed forces, those are the people who dominate information. So today, with the internet and social media, information has that potential to be more democratic and more broad-based. For me, that's a very positive thing that we should be, everybody should welcome.
Now, I agree with you completely about the kind of responsibility, if you like, and a more generous kind of interpretation that journalists took on for themselves representing people. And I agree with you that there is a kind of ideology of heroism in the media, you know, the high priests, as you like to call them. But for the most part, the configuration that you mentioned just now of the power elite, maybe it's a specifically a Filipino configuration, but it's also, you see it in much of Southeast Asia, power groups that control the media or control, you know, the way in which information flows. But at the end of the day, in Southeast Asia, there still remains a huge divide between people who have access to any kind of media, whether it's online or offline, and those who don't. And for them, where does your critique stand? How do people, whether it's in the Philippines or in Myanmar or in rural communities in Borneo, Malaysia or Indonesian Borneo, who do not have some really basic infrastructure, you know, in order to get the kind of information or interact in any kind of way?
That's a rather complicated question, but I'll try to answer it. Number one, for those with internet access, we hope that they use it for social good, to inform the public about what's happening, so that with information, with sufficient and relevant information, they'll be able to take action. At the same time, number two, they should, knowing that the internet technology is a good enabler, not just for expression or spreading information, but for wealth creation or spreading wealth, redistributing wealth. Those of us lucky enough to have access should advocate the bridging of the digital divide, so to speak. I know it's not as basic as water, land, livelihood, education, but those who have access now are mostly middle class and they are historically a very progressive class. And if they advocate change, something really happens. So, for example, if the young people in Malaysia or in Indonesia would use their social media power or social media capital to champion changes in their provinces, well and good, that would be epic or awesome. So I think I'm not speaking about the triumphalism of social media and the internet. I believe those technologies are tools, are enablers, and it all boils down to those who use it. Technology is always value-free. It always depends on the users of technology and how they use it. So there's another problem, for example, astroturfing or the use of cyber armies. That's the negative side. They spread hate, they spread fear to stop change. So that could be a negative example, but it shows that social media and internet access, if used properly, could bring about positive things. I think the best possible outcome in 5 to 10 years, maybe, is for media outlets, for them to go online, reach new audiences, use the extra time, the extra space to improve their coverage, help their audience by raising their awareness. That's practically the task of media. It's not just merely reporting, because why do we need politics to be reported or other stuff that media reports? Because some of those things need action. So hopefully with more people joining social media, even businesses, government, media itself, that would provide a space for the public to speak out. And we should always bear in mind that there are differences on a country-to-country basis. In the Philippines, there's no overt political repression, but there are radio journalists in our country that are being killed inside the radio booth, being shot to death. So maybe in the meantime, they could go online with their... That could be one positive thing that internet access could provide.
I'd like to end with just a quick discussion about, how media and social media, or any media in the Philippines can be a social changer, a game changer for Filipino society, considering that, one of the most vibrant and robust media systems in the region is actually in the Philippines, in terms of, we think of, it's also one of the most dangerous places in the world, never mind Southeast Asia, for a journalist to practice. You have a Maoist insurgency or a Maoist resistance to, the power elite in Manila and its revolving door of families and, all that you know about your society. I mean, can the media at the end of the day really change things for Filipinos and for the vast masses of Filipinos? And I just want to mention here that because the repression of community workers, the killing of the Bayan Muna party workers, I mean, these have been going on for years and it's past the 1,000 mark.
Yes. Again, I go back to the basic point that any media, any medium, is just a tool. So, for example, if the government could use it to deceive the public about any policy, but at the same time, the public could use it to defend themselves or to promote their interests. So I'm an advocate of greater use by political movements of the internet. I hope and pray that more of them would be online and would be going social, because the main audience that they want to reach are online. In the past few years, we've had very strong typhoons. And this is what gives me hope about the social good aspects of social media in particular. Using Twitter and Facebook and some Google apps, we were able to introduce and institutionalize, force government and businesses and mainstream media to use certain hashtags to report about storms, floods, and disasters. So, for example, #ReliefPH and #RescuePH, those have specific uses in the Philippines. So you check RescuePH for reports of people who need rescue during disasters. One way or another, they're able to tweet, maybe through their friends or to themselves. And then #ReliefPH is about relief operations being done by citizens, how we could help, where to bring donations, how to volunteer. So those are simple steps, but we were able to institutionalize those hashtags. And there have been efforts that have gone from online to offline that show the power of social media in bringing positive changes to the lives of the public. It's a case of show and tell. Just a few weeks ago, there was in a main thoroughfare in Manila, in EDSA, there was an incident with a number of people bearing high-powered guns. They stopped a car in the middle of the road and people were able to take photos. It became big news in social media. The bloggers posted them on Twitter. And it was discovered within a few days that they were high-ranking police officers doing something that they couldn't explain. So all of them have been suspended. All of these police officials have been suspended and charged. That big story was broken in social media by netizens and then later on reported by mainstream media. So I think slowly but surely, the public and media and the powerful in the Philippines are understanding the potentials of going online and going social. It really all boils down to how we use it, who uses it, and what for.
I was speaking to Filipino blogger Tonio Cruz during the Southeast Asian Press Alliance Conference on Media and Internet Freedom held in Kuala Lumpur recently. That's all we have for you this morning. I hope it's been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. You've been listening to The Week in Review. I'm Sharad Kutin, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.